I have been thinking about so many different software projects and software systems that I have built throughout my lifetime and throughout my career. And as you can imagine, when you engage in those pieces of software, right, you had the ideas down on paper, you had what was in your head, but at some point you had to put hands on keyboard, you had to put keys in, keystrokes in, and code into the system. And of course, the actual software had to come to life. And most importantly, that software had to make it to production and become a living, breathing thing that users engaged with, where you could get real feedback. But all along that journey, things fundamentally changed from the moment you had it as an idea in your head to software actually built and compiled and ready to run. And of course, software and a system that users actually saw. So I've been thinking about that as I talked to Ben Darnell, co-founder and CTO of Cockroach Labs, the distributed database company. And I find that name, Cockroach Labs, so very interesting.
The name's been really good. It's a really distinctive, memorable name. Unlike some of our peers in the database space, it's once you hear CockroachDB, you'll always remember us. But when you get outside of tech circles, it can be a little more of a liability. I was applying for a mortgage a couple of years ago and got asked whether I owned an exterminator company.
I can imagine you out there with a backpack on, a little spray can, you know, making sure that you fix all the bugs in someone's house. This is Code Comments, an original podcast from Red Hat. I'm Burr Sutter, and here again is Ben Darnell.
So the story actually starts about 10 years ago at another startup called Viewfinder. We were building a mobile photo sharing app. And I was with Spencer Kimball and Peter Mattis, who would go on to be my co-founders at Cockroach Labs. We'd all spent a lot of time at Google, and this was one of our first experiences building an app from scratch outside of Google. And so we were looking around for databases to use, and we were really kind of disappointed in everything that we saw. We had gotten used to Google's in-house technologies like GFS and Bigtable, and all these kinds of massively scalable and highly available systems. And we were looking at what our options were out in the real world, and nothing really satisfied us. We were looking at things like sharding MySQL or Cassandra or HBase or DynamoDB. We saw all these things as having a lot of compromises for our use case in comparison to some of the things that we'd used before. And so Spencer, my co-founder, actually wrote the first version of the CockroachDB design doc while we were at Viewfinder. And, you know, Peter and I kind of had to talk him down because we couldn't build a world-class database and the next big photo sharing app at the same time.
So you obviously discovered while at Google, there was these limitations in the actual database server that you're using there. But at the same time, when you came out of Google, I don't know if you landed directly at the startup at that point in time, but you certainly were finding limitations with the open source ecosystem as it stood, meaning you looked at MySQL, you looked at Cassandra's, you looked at PostgreSQL, et cetera, and you found limits there. Can you tell us more about that journey from Google all the way into that startup and where you were looking at the open source ecosystem around databases?
Sure. So I actually went through a number of startups in between Google and this photo sharing startup. I was at FriendFeed right before they got acquired by Facebook, and a startup called Brizzly, which got acquired by AOL. And then I'd been at Dropbox for a couple of years. And all of these startups, they all had something in common. They were all using sharded MySQL as their primary data store. And so I got to see really firsthand how painful that could be at large scale. And I knew that that was not something that I was eager to sign up for again, because we saw that as the system grows, all these different shards, they all fail independently. But when you get up to Dropbox's scale, for example, there were database shards failing on a weekly basis and needing manual intervention to clean that up. Whereas at Google, with Bigtable and systems like that, we just didn't have to worry about individual failures in the same way. One thing that really defines the CockroachDB approach is that at scale, failures become very frequent. You can have small partial failures on a daily or weekly basis, and it's important to make these non-events. And that means that, you know, instead of having a big process for failing over from a primary database to a secondary, you have an automated process that can move a small chunk of data over from its primary to its secondary transparently and without losing any data. This is a big difference with a lot of traditional databases, is that failover comes with a risk of losing the last little bit of data whenever you flip the switch. But in CockroachDB, everything is replicated consistently so that the failure doesn't lose any data, and therefore you can have this failover process be much more automated and faster and less disruptive because you know it's not going to lose any of your data.
One of the things that's fundamental to the architecture, right, is that you guys have a distributed database. It's a distributed system. And that means there could be network partitions, there could be network failure in between any of the nodes, there could be a node failure, meaning one of the actual database engines just goes away, the virtual machine it's in or the actual hardware it's on just dies. Can you talk more about how that consensus is reached? How does that, what algorithm are you using within this context?
The whole system is built on a distributed consensus algorithm to bring all the nodes in the cluster into sync. The specific algorithm that we use is called Raft. It was very recent when we first started using it. It was just a couple of years old at that point. The classic distributed consensus algorithm is called Paxos, and it's notoriously complex and hard to understand. Raft came along in the last decade and promised to be a much easier to understand and implement consensus algorithm, and so that's what we chose to use in CockroachDB. And the essential idea in all of these distributed consensus algorithms is that they're all more or less built around the idea of running a lot of little elections. And so you have you typically have a leader. In CockroachDB, we have a leader for each range of data. So we have many, the data is divided up into many, many chunks called ranges, and each of those has its own leader so that this leadership responsibility can be spread across all of the nodes in the cluster. And whenever you want to write to the database, that essentially gets put to a vote of all the replicas of that piece of data, and you need a majority of those to come back. And so that's what gives you the ability to survive failures, because you can have, you don't need all of the nodes to respond. You just need 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 5. And so you're able to tolerate 1 or 2 node failures at any given time. And then you have enough nodes that survive that have the data that are able to then replace any copies that that get lost. This is the key mechanism that we use to ensure that your data is always safe, no matter what happens to the underlying machines and hardware.
So what Ben is telling us is that when you actually have distributed work, a distributed piece of software around multiple machines, especially with a network in between, things can go badly, things can break. And what you want to make sure is that your consensus algorithm, your consensus protocol, is verifying that enough of the machines acknowledge that they have written the data properly. And if you've done that, you can feel very secure and very safe that your software and your data has been persisted correctly. Conceptualizing an algorithm on paper, certainly designing it out, is one thing. But actually building it into a piece of software where you have to put hands on keyboard and create the code is a whole different thing altogether. Ben told me about his actual experience where he actually started laying down the keystrokes and building out that code around the consensus algorithm and how that fit into the overall perspective of what they needed to build for Cockroach Labs.
I started working in Cockroach in earnest at a Hack Week when we were working at Square, and Cockroach was just an open source project at this time. And so I had this Hack Week blocked off, and my first the first code that I wrote for CockroachDB was actually an implementation of Raft. And in that week, I was able to implement, I would say, probably the first 80% of the Raft algorithm. And then it turns out that, you know, we'd spend upwards of the next year working on what I'd say is the last 20%. So getting started, we were able to implement the happy path where you have a fixed set of nodes and, you know, there's no failures or there's certain types of failures and everything is proceeding fairly normally and everything's working and, you know, certain types of failures are tolerated. But then where it really gets tricky is when you have to deal with changing the membership of the cluster. The simple implementation of a distributed consensus algorithm always starts just talking about the membership of the cluster being a fixed thing supplied from the outside. But if you want to run this at scale, you've got to have nodes entering and leaving the cluster in a fairly automated way. And so you need to be able to safely add and remove nodes. This is where a lot of the subtlety comes in. There's you need to make sure that the nodes that are being removed from service are properly removed and they're able to sync up with all their peers before they go so that you don't leave the cluster in a fragile state. And you need you need to introduce new nodes in a way that everyone agrees on who gets a vote, essentially, in those elections. You've got to make sure that the membership roster of the cluster is very consistently maintained. On paper, it tends to be a small fraction of what the protocol looks like. You know, there's maybe a page or two out of a 15-page paper on Raft devoted to this topic. But in terms of implementation complexity, it's much hairier than it looks.
I do appreciate the point you made there about the happy path and the fact that, you know, something as simple as how many nodes there are to begin with and how nodes maybe join the cluster or leave the cluster over time, that represents a much harder, a much more challenging set of algorithms, if you will, and things to figure out as you pull all those elements together.
Yeah. You know, this next 20% kind of took us the better part of a year. But then in the course of that year, we ended up connecding with the team working on etcd at CoreOS. And they had one of the most mature Go language implementations of Raft at the time. And they were kind of going through the same thing. They had implemented the first 80%+ of the protocol, and they were working through all of the final edge cases. And so they were realizing how much work was still ahead of them and us, and how much overlap there was. And so they suggested that we join forces and share a single implementation.
You mentioned that you were doing this over at Square, and you were able to contribute that code to an open source project, it sounds like, at the time. But there were other maturing implementations based for the Raft protocol in Go, written in the Golang programming language. That was etcd, and also from HashiCorp. Is that correct?
Yeah. So when we were starting the CockroachDB project, well, there were a lot of implementations of Raft in Go at the time, actually. Because of the timing of the Raft paper and the introduction of the Go programming language, it turns out that a lot of people have used Raft as kind of a starter project to learn the Go language, which is an interesting trend that we saw in whatever year this was, about 2014. So before I started implementing Raft from scratch by myself, I looked at the two major competing implementations from HashiCorp and CoreOS, and saw that they weren't quite suitable for us. One of the things that's unusual about CockroachDB and the way that we use distributed consensus algorithms is that we run a lot of different instances of the algorithm. So in CockroachDB, we divide the data up into many thousands of independent ranges, each of which is a separate instantiation of the Raft protocol. Whereas in something like etcd or console, you really just have one instance of Raft for the entire system. And so we're very concerned about the scalability of the protocol implementation. And so we saw that that both etcd and console's Raft implementations would do things like start up Go routines in the background for the protocol. And this kind of background processing, when you multiply it by 1,000 or 10,000 different instances of the algorithm running in parallel, this can really be a drain on the node's resources. And so we needed to be able to run many instances of Raft without the overhead of a Go routine per instance. And that was the original reason why I started implementing the protocol from scratch, even though there were these existing high-quality implementations out there.
Well, one thing I really love about the story you're telling us here is that it started with a proprietary solution to a hard problem, in this case, a distributed computing, a distributed database. And then as you moved out of that organization into more startups, you then found that this did not exist in this world. And what's amazing about this from an open source perspective is you, as a software engineer, had that itch you wanted to scratch. You had that problem you wanted to solve, and you did not see a perfect solution in the space. Even if there were other open source projects that were already implementing the Raft protocol in Go, you know, in the Go programming language, like the folks over at etcd and HashiCorp. And then you found that collaborative opportunity with some of these other players in the market to actually really build out that element of your application architecture. I would like to double click and drill down just for a moment on that multi-Raft idea, the multi-Raft protocol, because you mentioned that, you know, the current open source implementations out there were single Raft implementations. They had those background Go routines that were somewhat problematic, at least at great scale. Can you describe for, let's say, our average listener who's only perhaps just worked with a relational database before, not necessarily thought too much about sharding per se, or the fact that, you know, there's sort of these different indexing solutions. What does that really look like from the user's perspective, that multi-Raft protocol, that ability to, you know, basically use Raft around, I assume, what is a group of rows in the database?
Well, for one thing, to an end user of CockroachDB, it doesn't really look like much because it's all happening under the hood. It's all basically invisible. But in terms of what we mean when we say multi-Raft, this is about the fact that one server in your CockroachDB cluster may be responsible for 10, 20, 30,000 ranges. And so you're running, you know, 30,000 instances of the Raft protocol in a 10-node cluster, for example. You're going to have a lot of overlap in the membership of those Raft instances. And so one of the things that Raft has to do is it has to send heartbeats between all the different peers of the node. And so you have these heartbeats going back and forth with these nodes just essentially asking each other, are you alive and able to respond? And so these messages are flying back and forth. But if you're, you know, in the CockroachDB case, you don't want to have 30,000 heartbeat messages flying back and forth every second. That just, you know, wastes all your computing resources. You want to be able to say, you know, I see that I've got 10,000 Raft groups, but I've only got 9 actual peers. So I want to be able to send 9 heartbeats instead of 30,000. That's the kind of thing that we do in multi-Raft, is we recognize the higher level structure and try to coalesce and consolidate a lot of this background activity across the many different independent Raft groups that exist under the hood.
I can see how this is incredibly valuable as the number of nodes grows, as well as the volume of data in that database grows, right? You want to make sure that it's not so chatty across the wire and there's not so much interaction, as you mentioned, just the heartbeat going back and forth. That does add a ton of overhead, both at the CPU level as well as the network chattiness, right? For these things to simply say, hey, I'm still alive. I'm still okay. We don't need to elect another leader at this point in time. Can you tell us more about that last 20%, right? If we had 80% done in a single week and you were working with these new partners, what did it take to actually get us the rest of the way? What kind of issues did you bump into? What kind of problems did you solve?
Yeah, so the last 20% is all about kind of chasing down all of the corner cases and edge cases. So in the RAF protocol, as we implemented it, it turned out to be very safe in the sense that we never had a lot of problems with the protocol doing a bad thing. But we did have problems with liveness, the way that under adverse conditions, it would fail to do anything at all. That was really, trying to maximize that availability was really the long tail of work to get to 100% done. And of course, you can never make it perfectly available. This is one of the things we learned from the CAP theorem. RAFT is ultimately not an available protocol in the CAP theorem's terminology. It's a consistent protocol, and so it does have times where it can't make progress. But trying to get as close to that ideal as we can in practical real world situations.
Well, you mentioned CAP theorem there, and certainly a lot of people have definitely heard about that, and right, there's always the concept of, well, you get 2 out of 3, right, in that scenario, which is, we know, not exactly accurate, but the concept of consistency versus availability when facing a network partition, right? So the network partition being a key aspect of that, the failure between the different nodes. So in that case, you mentioned that availability versus consistency, it sounds like CockroachDB focuses on the consistency side, and RAFT algorithm, RAFT protocol definitely had you focus on that.
That's right. So the CAP theorem says that in the face of a partition, we're a distributed system. We can't choose to be partition intolerant because partitions will always happen. So that means we have to choose when there is a partition, we have to choose whether we're going to keep consistency or availability. And so when push comes to shove, when we have to choose one or the other, we always choose consistency. But within that framework, the CAP theorem's trade-offs only apply in a fairly narrow window of situations. And so the vast majority of the time when we're doing things to improve the availability of the system, we're not anywhere near the limits where the CAP theorem starts to apply.
Getting to 1.0 is always an amazing moment. Your software, your creation, now has to face real end users. And getting your very first customer for a database is not so easy. It is a non-trivial thing that you're asking people to do. As you know, data is one of the most important assets in your organization. Ben told me a story about one of their biggest and earliest customers having a failure that resulted in data loss and how his team rallied to address it.
There were actually two different versions of the RAFT paper. The first version described a very complicated membership change protocol called joint consensus, which was very robust, but was very, very complex to implement. And then there was a second paper on RAFT, which introduced a major simplification in this area. It said that you didn't need the joint consensus protocol as long as you were only ever adding or removing one node at a time. And so we said, that's great. We'll just implement the simpler version. The problem is that if you want to move a replica instead of just adding or reducing capacity, that means you have to model it as an add followed by a remove or a remove followed by an add. And if you model it as a remove followed by an add, which happened to be the way that we implemented it at first, then you're in this very fragile state in between. So you originally have a 3-replica configuration, and you need 2 out of 3 to be able to make progress. If you go down to 2 replicas, then all of a sudden you can't handle any more failures. You need 2 out of 2 to be a majority, because if you just have one vote in a 2-member cluster, then that's a tie. And so there's this window in between going down from 3 to 2 and then coming back up to 3, where you're vulnerable. You can have one loss that can lead you to losing your quorum. And this sounds like it's a risk of going down from 3 to 2 before coming back up. It actually works out in the other way as well. If you go from 3 nodes, add the 4th node before removing one of the nodes, that can lead to problems, especially in a multi-region or multi-data center case, because then you find yourself with 4 nodes instead of 3. And if you have 3 data centers that you're working with, then 2 of those nodes have to be in the same data center, and they could suffer correlated failures. That's something that we saw here, where one of these customer clusters experienced two failures at the same time because of a region or availability zone data center outage. And then because it happened at just the wrong time when the cluster had temporarily up-replicated into this more fragile state, then they lost quorum and that range was broken until we could get in to manually fix it. And so in order to fix this, we did some quick fixes at first to try and repair the immediate damage to get this user cluster back up and running. The long-term fix was to go back to this feature of joint consensus that was featured in the original Raft paper, but was kind of deprecated and almost removed from the second edition because it wasn't seen as being practically necessary. But at least in our, again, coming back to multi-raft and the way that we have this large number of Raft protocol instances undergoing constant up and down replications, we were much more vulnerable to this risk from doing the one replica at a time change. And so we needed a protocol that could actually guarantee that it was going to be correct, even in the face of failures during the membership change process. And so this ended up not getting fixed until, I think it was about 2 years after 1.0. It was just a very sizable project. We needed to lay the groundwork over a long period of time to be able to make that transition. But in the end, again, because we were working with the etcd team on this, the work that we were doing here was also able to benefit that project as well.
What I find interesting about this part of the story is that you guys actually saw that there was a great need for something that other people perceived as optional, right? You mentioned the atomic replica changes, the replication happening, right, and having guarantees, if you will, as to how those replicas get started up, get shut down, and making sure that there are happening, let's say in this case, across multiple availability zones. I want to know more about that because that suggests to me that other people had not gotten to the level of complexity in terms of their implementation with the Raft protocol that you guys had, or they had not pushed it enough in production to see some of these edge cases occur in a real production environment with a real distributed database engine. Why do you think you guys were the first ones to really kind of stumble across that and realize optionality or being optional was not really optional?
I think it comes down to the fact that when you're operating at scale, everything has to be automated. There's an assumption in a lot of these papers, you know, the reason that the Raft authors decided that you didn't really need the more complex protocol is because they were envisioning adding a replica to the system to be kind of a rare manual event. It would be an operator somewhere pushing a button, and that operator would presumably know to, you know, look at the network status and not do it when, if there's any signs of trouble. So it's only going to be executed under kind of best case conditions. So, you know, it's just not considered a completely routine operation like it has to be when you're operating at massive scale.
Well, you mentioned that you guys discovered that you needed this capability by working with a real world customer who was actually having a real world struggle at that moment. I'm kind of curious to know, what did your world look like at the moment you guys realized there was a real customer with a real problem for, you know, losing data, they had downtime, and of course they wanted to get back up again and get back to processing again. But was it a whole company, you know, hair on fire, we got to ring the fire alarm and get focused on it? Can you kind of describe the environment and how you guys reacted to that situation? And then of course then discovered, okay, this optional thing is really not that optional. We need to really understand how to make this better.
Yeah, so obviously as a database, especially a transactional database, making the kinds of guarantees that we claim to offer for availability and consistency, obviously losing customer data is just the worst thing we can do. And so we want to throw all available resources at the problem whenever it happens. You know, this became the top priority. We were cranking out tools kind of on the fly to try and do a little surgery on the data on disk to try and bring the cluster back up as quickly as possible. And then the long-term fix happened at a less extreme pace, because we had to, we wouldn't be able to ship that feature before a lot of testing and our next major release anyway.
And I like how you mentioned you guys were engineering new tools basically on the fly to basically say, hey, execute this, execute that. And this doesn't sound like these were just simple bash shell scripts that you had to create for the customer. These were new Go algorithms, new Go routines that you guys had to create, and they had to execute those executables, right?
That's right. Yeah, this was new Go code that was written and being built into the CockroachDB binary. So we were shipping them new releases of CockroachDB on the fly.
Oh, well, there's an aspect of Agile you don't hear about every day. We're patching our actual core engine and shipping the whole thing yet again. So you're doing multiple releases within an hour in this case, it sounds like, or a few hours. How long was the window that you guys were working in this state?
Fortunately, because of the way data is divided up in CockroachDB, this did not manifest as a total outage for the customer. It was the cluster was still, 99%+ available. It was just that there were certain records that were that were unavailable, and so the customer was able to get by in this state. It ended up taking us I don't remember exactly it. It was a couple of days, I think, to get it all done.
Well, you bring up a great point there about the fact that not everything was down. I think that's something that I missed initially, and we probably should talk about a little bit more. The name Cockroach suggests this thing is unkillable. Most of the application and users' applications in the database was up and running. Everything was okay, except for a few isolated records. And that's related to the way you guys actually distribute the data. And therefore, it was only this one subset that was had problems. And so that's incredibly powerful. Just that alone is a powerful story where if the customer is continuing on trucking, but they just had a problem in one area, that's a massive win for the customer, as well as the a testament, if you will, to the architecture and the solution you guys have created. Well, I got to ask you this particular element because I'm very curious. Normally, in the case of software engineering, when we run into a failure, often we learn from that. We actually learn more from our failures than we do from our successes in many cases. So based on that concept, right, that you had to go through some learning. Can I tell me how this plays out? What lessons did you guys learn and how did it impact your journey as a company and a corporation, as a team, as you guys continue to learn from that experience as well as others?
Well, one lesson from this, it turns out that the issue around atomic replication changes was something that we had kind of made a note of early on, and we filed an issue in our issue tracker on GitHub and then kind of forgot about it, because it seemed like it was such a remote possibility. One of the lessons from this is that it really is important to go through your backlog of old issues, because there may be real things hiding there. If something doesn't feel right and it makes you think you need to file an issue about it, there's a very real chance that it will come back to bite you later.
Ben's real-world experience, where their software and the hands of real end users might be used in a way not previously anticipated, where a rare manual event, that remote possibility, like adding a replica to the database, might be an edge case. Because as we all know, software's never finished. The happy path is one thing, but it's those edge cases that often get us. I really love hearing these stories of real-world software deliveries, stories just like Ben's about founding Cockroach Labs, because we can all learn from them. We want to thank Ben Darnell for coming on the show. Thanks also to Aika Zikibaeva, Joe Gomes, Michael Waite, John Gibson, and Victoria Lawton. This episode was produced by Brent Simino and Caroline Craighead. Our sound designer is Christian Proham. Our audio team includes Lee Day, Stephanie Wunderlich, Mike Esser, Johan Philippine, Kim Wong, Nick Burns, Aaron Williamson, Karen King, Jared Oates, Rachel Ortel, Devin Pope, Matthias Foundes, Mike Compton, Ocean Matthews, Alex Trabulsi, and Victoria Lawton. I'm Burr Sutter, and this is Code Comments, an original podcast from Red Hat. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll join us again next time.